each member of your committee for this wonderful service you have rendered. Brethren, I want to call your attention to a rather unfortunate oversight in the printing of the program. Dr. Baker Coffin is our main speaker for the closing session tonight, and his name was inadvertently left off. I wish that you'd help us make it known to every messenger of the convention, inside and outside the hall and wherever you see them, and that urge that unless you have to go, come to this evening service. There'll be a great period of inspiring music for some 15 minutes, and Dr. Coffin will bring our convention to a great climax. I'm sorry that that was overlooked, but I did want you to know it, that our main messenger for the evening hour, Dr. Baker James Coffin, Executive Secretary of our Foreign Mission Board. No man among us is more capable of bringing the convention to such excellent conclusion as Dr. Coffin. So let's make that known throughout the afternoon and urge a great attendance here tonight. We come now to be blessed by special music again. Brother Capps will announce.
I believe you would like to sing one stanza of number 15, Oh, for a Thousand Tongues to Sing. Shall we stand? To have the Atlanta Association Choir, which sang at the Baptist World Alliance at this last meeting, and they're going to bring us our message and song at this time. This group is directed by Mr. G. Stanley Powell, and they'll present the music. Thank you.
Thank you. Certainly our special music has been superb. How would you boys like to have a choir like that to crank up on Sunday morning before you tried to preach? Be wonderful, wouldn't it? We come now to the order of business. Recognition of the Christian Vocations Committee, Dr. Alan W. Graves, Chairman of Kentucky.
President, fellow messengers and friends, we come this morning to bring to you the report of a special committee established by this convention last year at Kansas City. Members, these some members of the committee are on the platform. Their names are listed in the book of reports on page 291. But I'd like to ask the members of this special committee to stand if they will. Thank you. Some of you have been asking, what is this committee attempting to do? What is its purpose? In order to best answer your question, we should like to suggest that you turn in your book of reports to page 7 and 8, if you have them still, that you might see the first report, the initial report of this committee, to the executive committee. As instructed by the convention last year, the committee brought a report to the executive committee of the Southern Baptist Convention, and that report is printed in the book of reports on pages 7 and 8. You will note there that this special committee was assigned the responsibility to, quote, to study the need for workers in church-related positions, particularly in the fields of missions, religious education, and church music. The committee was instructed to seek proper means of confronting young people with the opportunities and possibilities of such service. The committee was requested to suggest provision for appropriate recognition and status for those serving in such church-related vocations. We were asked to recommend a unified and effective procedure for encouraging the enrollment of such young people in our Baptist colleges and seminaries to the end that they may be adequately equipped for their divinely appointed life work. The need for such a committee became even more apparent as the committee began to discover the demands not only for workers in church positions, in educational and church music staff positions, but also for service in our several denominational agencies. The expanding of the personnel of both foreign and home mission boards created further demand for trained workers. I think it would be interesting here this morning to see how many of you come from churches that are at this present moment seeking an additional staff member. Perhaps a mission pastor, minister of education, an educational worker, youth worker, recreational worker, church secretary, minister of music, or some other such staff member in your church. You're looking for one just now. Would you raise your hand? That is not surprising that so large a group should be thus represented. Mr. Edmonds of the Department of Survey, Statistics, and Information reported that about this time last year, 3,000, not 30,000 as you find it in the book of reports, that's an error, 3,000 churches were seeking such workers at that time. Now that's the reason, one of the reasons for the work of this committee. The fact that we have so many unfilled positions and so few people to fill them. You will find also in the book of reports the conclusions that the committee reached as to why this condition prevailed. We undertook to discover why more young people were not entering these church-related vocations, since thousands of those who had made life service commitments were not following through. Why is it that they are not now ready to fill these positions when a few years ago the people who could now be filling the jobs were coming forward at Ridgecrest, at Glorietta, in state assemblies, in your revival meetings, in youth weeks? What was wrong that there was not the follow-through? We are undertaking to find out what needs to be done in order that these people whom God has called, people upon whose shoulder the touch of God's hand has come, why is it that they have not pursued their preparation to prepare for these church-related vocations to which they have been called of God? We found that one of the most serious problems was the lack of information on the part of young people, of their parents and the church leaders, about the nature of a divine call to such vocations and the needs and the qualifications for service in church-related vocations. We found a serious lack of guidance materials to put into the hands of interested young people and those who would counsel with them concerning their vocational planning. We found, too, that some faced problems in entering these fields of service because of uncertainty or insecurity or dissatisfaction about the existing status of such workers and the attitude that was prevalent toward them in the church, in the community, and in the denomination. We feel that this year of work has brought about considerable progress. We're happy to report to you on that progress. As requested by the Executive Committee, the Sunday School Board has added a staff member to serve in this field of church-related vocations counseling, and he is here today to tell you something about what the committee has done and what he and his office are hoping to do in the matter of providing adequate materials and also in giving some organizational structure to a program of counseling and guidance for those who are being called of the Lord into these vocations. I should like to present to you at this time Mr. John M. Tubbs, a native of Florida, graduate of Southern Seminary, a successful pastor, and for the past 10 years, a very successful training union secretary in Virginia. He has recently come to the staff of the Sunday School Board to work in this area, and I'd like for you to hear at this moment a report on his stewardship. Mr. John M. Tubbs.
Thank you, Dr. Graves, Mr. President, and members of the convention. It is indeed a great privilege to assume this part of the work at the Sunday School Board, and I'm deeply grateful for the privilege of joining the very fine staff of members whom we now have serving our convention through the Baptist Sunday School Board. You have already heard from this platform a number of times during this convention the thing reiterated that our president has called to our attention: the fact that Southern Baptists stand today on the verge of one of the greatest opportunities to advance that has ever faced this convention. At the same time, I should like to point out to you that the degree to which we move into these opportunities will be in direct proportion to the willingness of thousands of young people in the churches of the Southern Baptist Convention to become willing to say, "Here am I, Lord, send me." There is a tremendous need for thousands of young people, as Dr. Baker James Cawthon challenged us on Monday night, to come into those relationships where they are willing to accept God's will for their lives and help in this gigantic task. Let me hasten to say, however, that much has been done already through the very fine efforts of our Sunday schools, the training union, the Baptist Student Union, the auxiliaries of the WMU, the RAs, the Education Commission, and the personnel departments of our foreign and home mission boards. We are able to report presently that there are thousands of young people who are now in training for places of service in church-related vocations. At the same time, there has never been any concerted effort on the part of the convention to make available from one source guidance materials and other information concerning all of the various types of church and denominational work. Therefore, the work of this new office at the Sunday School Board will try in a general way to give leadership in four major areas. Number one will be the development of guidance materials for young people themselves, describing opportunities of service available through our churches and the various denominational agencies. I'm sure that all of us who have been in young people's work at any time are quite familiar with the fact that there is a tremendous shortage of materials in this area. There are scores and scores of leaders with young people who are writing to say, "Can you send me some information that will tell our young people of the opportunities of service that are available?" It will be our purpose to develop such materials. Let me add a word of caution here, if I may. Please do not write to us as soon as you go home and ask for those materials. It will take months to prepare them, to be sure. You will be interested to know, however, that the Training Union Department of the Sunday School Board now has in the process of publication a series of graded study course books in the area of church-related vocations, which will be available for the March study courses next year. The second major area will be in the development of counseling materials for leaders of young people in our churches. The leaders themselves need to know how to interpret the call of God to these fine young people. They need a good theology of vocation in order to lead young people to know and to accept God's will for their lives. At this point, you'll be interested to know also that Broadman Press now has in the process of production a new book, which will be available in the bookstores possibly by the month of August, written by Dr. Samuel Southard of Texas under the title Counseling for Church Vocations. The third major area of concern will be that of cooperating with the various church, associational, and state organizations in the promotion of conferences on church-related vocations. Recently, the Training Union Department of the State of Tennessee sponsored a weekend statewide conference for volunteers for church-related service. Some 200 of our finest young people in the state of Tennessee came together for that weekend. They're under the leadership of competent personnel through addresses, panel discussions, and conferences. They were helped tremendously to find their places of service. Finally, the fourth major area will have to do with that of maintaining personal correspondence files with those whose names you send to us in an effort to correspond with them, put into their hands periodically material in this field, help them to help to answer questions concerning their preparation and other types of correspondence. You'll help us at that point if you will send to us the names of those who volunteer in your churches. We want to be of the maximum service to them. Let me say that in the promotion of this program, there is not envisioned any new department of work at the Sunday School Board. Rather, this work is in a staff relationship with Dr. W.L. House, Director of the Education Division. It will be our purpose to work through the regularly established channels of education in our churches and on our college campuses. In conclusion, let me say that this program is based upon three very strong convictions which we believe to be Bible-centered. In the first place, we believe in the Lordship of Christ in every life. We need to remind ourselves that when one accepts Jesus Christ as Savior of his life, he also at the same time accepts the Lordship of Christ over his life and commits his life to the doing of God's will through that life. Secondly, we affirm our belief in the fact that God leads all of his followers who are willing to follow into places of service. To be sure, God's leadership is not limited just to the church-related vocations, but he leads people into all types of work according to the talents with which he has endowed them. At this point, of course, we are particularly concerned to help young people hear and respond to the call to church-related vocations. And there are thousands of calls, as indicated already by Dr. Graves. The third general principle upon which this work is based is our conviction again, and an equally strong conviction, that it is God who calls. This program is not envisioned to be a program of human recruitment. We are not deluded by the fact that we, in our own human efforts, can recruit people for church-related vocations. Rather, our purpose will be to prepare and make available information and counseling services through which young people will be enabled the better to hear and respond to God's call. We are quite conscious of the fact that God calls through an awareness of need, through an understanding of one's abilities, through the counsel of interested and concerned persons, and through a willingness to prepare for that work. Will you not join us in prayer to the end that God will send forth laborers into the field that we may do the job that God has asked Southern Baptists to do in this great program of advance?
Thank you, Mr. Tubbs. I hope that all of you realize that this is your responsibility. The people whom we seek for the churches must be God-called people who come from your churches, who have prayed with you and counseled with you, who have received from you direction and encouragement as they seek to prepare for the work to which God is calling. We are confident that you will assist these young people and that you will call upon Mr. Tubbs and the others in the states as they project this program of counseling. But there is yet much to be done. You are aware of the fact that in the report of the Executive Committee on last Wednesday morning, this committee was enlarged and continued to perform a still further purpose. We were instructed by you last year to suggest provision of appropriate recognition and status. We realize that this is a matter that is and must properly always be a matter for the churches themselves to determine. And so the original committee requested the enlargement of the committee by additional pastors and other church workers. Such an enlarged committee, with your help and with your prayer, we hope will be able to find the right answer, God's answer, the New Testament answer to this matter of finding an appropriate way of recognizing those whom God has called. It is the hope of the committee that we may be able to bring to you some suggestions at this point, realizing that our suggestions must always be only that, and that you in the churches, as you seek the leadership of the Holy Spirit and the knowledge of the Word of God, will find the right answer. Mr. President, I should like to move the adoption of the report, which does not contain any recommendation.
Is there a second? Any further discussion? The time is up. As many as favor the adoption of the report, would you indicate it by saying aye? Any opposed will say no, and it is so ordered. I know that we greatly appreciate the fine work which this committee is doing. It is in a most important field as we look forward to the great program that God has given us in these years just ahead. Coming now to the Committee on Time, Place, and Preacher.
Brother Willard.
Brother President, messengers to the convention, your committee was charged with the responsibility of recommending to you a preacher and alternate for the convention which meets in Houston, Texas, May 18th, 23rd, 1958, and to suggest a place and time of meeting for the convention in 1960. Two requests have come to perhaps all the members of the committee, asking that we try to name a time earlier than this date so that we might avoid graduation from schools and that we have a place of meeting near the hotels. The time and place to be recommended will meet the requirements of these requests. We are grateful to Dr. Ruth and Dr. Hastings and the committee of the Executive Committee for assembling a great deal of information concerning prospective meeting places. We had three cities who qualified according to your constitution and requirements, the cities of Cincinnati, Ohio, St. Louis, Missouri, and Miami Beach, Florida. We come to make this recommendation that the preacher for 1958 be Robert E. Naylor, Texas, alternate preacher Harold W. Seaver, Alabama, The time for the 1960 meeting, the week of May 13th, and the place for the meeting, Miami Beach, Florida. Now, there is a word of explanation. This is Miami Beach, Florida, not Miami. Two or three things. They're building now a new exhibition hall to be completed next year, which will seat 15,000 people. It's adjacent to the recently constructed auditorium, seating up to 4,500 people. Other meeting rooms are in this new hall, and large hotel meeting rooms can be had on the beach without charge. They have promised up to 15,000 hotel rooms on the beach at popular prices, many of them in walking distance of the meeting place. If it is necessary for you to drive from the hotel to the exhibition hall, there will be provided 4,000 parking places. The convention offices of the City of Miami Beach will handle the Southern Baptist Convention Housing Bureau without charge. They will also provide 250 woman hours for registration without charge. Therefore, Mr. President, I move the adoption of this report.
Is there a second? Any discussion? Not as many as favor the adoption of the report will say aye. And the opposed will say no. It is so ordered. You'll indulge us just a moment. Brother Graves has a matter that he overlooked.
There's a clarification question on this report.
Okay.
The question on this report didn't say the exact time, just said the week of May 13th.
Secretary Burton called our attention to the fact that the exact time should be stated. Do we have that, Brother Bullard?
Each year the statement of the exact date. This says simply the week of May 13. It's not exact.
I will ask that this committee reconvene if necessary, set the exact date. It will be announced at the time of adjournment tonight. No objection? We'll follow that course. That'll give them time to think it over and maybe get a calendar.
Mr. President, could we ask them to meet immediately back at the platform?
Brother Bullard is calling for a meeting of this committee immediately right back at the platform. Time, place, and preacher committee go immediately with Brother Bullard. Dr. Graves?
Mr. President, at the request of the senior secretary, Dr. Merritt, we are asking that you officially entitle the committee, which just brought to you the report, the Church-Related Vocations Committee. There's been some confusion as to the exact title of it. I should like to move that the title of this special committee be designated as the Church-Related Vocations Committee.
Is there a second? And in discussion? Not as many as favor that will indicate it by saying aye. Any opposed will say no. It is so ordered. Coming now to the Committee on Public Affairs, I recognize Dr. Walter Pope Binns, Chairman of this committee. Dr. Binns.
Mr. President, I read the relatively brief report which is being submitted by the Executive Secretary to the several cooperating conventions. A revised constitution for the direction of the work of the Baptist Joint Committee was approved, as you will recall, by the Southern Baptist Convention at the 1956 meeting in Kansas City. This constitution was subsequently approved by the American Baptist Convention and by the Baptist General Conference of America at their 1956 meetings. Favorable action by other groups are expected at their next general sessions, inasmuch as the instrument seems to have received a very general acceptance. The committee has continued in its work toward consensus among Baptists as to the right application of our Christian insights to problems in church-state relations. During the year, the services of the office have been sought by an increasing number of Baptist agencies wishing consultations on the meaning of the application of the principle of separation of church and state. The biblical basis of this principle
its validity today have been the subjects of studies by groups of editors, college administrators, hospital administrators, and community and church leaders, with the active assistance of our office and its secretary in Washington. In the meantime, the office has also continued to study the Washington scene and to share its observations on church-state problems with the leadership of the several cooperating conventions. The findings of special research efforts have been shared with the responsible delegation. The director has also participated with many different non-Baptist conference groups and meetings for the interpretation of the Baptist witness. Plans have been developing for a broader educational effort among our people, looking forward to a larger public significance of the spiritual principles involved in our message. Not only has the work of this committee as constituted become increasingly important, but the necessity of carrying its information and organization into our work on the state and local levels has become more apparent during the year. Many of the issues of religious liberty are at these lower levels of government. Two Baptist state conventions have established standing committees on public affairs. They have set an example which may well be followed by all of the Baptist state conventions. Such committees can work with the Committee on Public Affairs of the Southern Baptist Convention to study church-state relations and to influence legislation and law enforcement in behalf of religious liberty and separation of church and state. These state bodies can be especially effective in dealing with the church-state problems within their own state. And now, Mr. President, I want to call a special attention to a conference which we plan to hold in Washington in connection with the annual meeting of the Joint Committee on Public Affairs. This conference will be called for October the 8th to the 10th. We are inviting the editors of our Baptist papers in the South and the chairman of these new state committees on public affairs. And in addition to that, we are urging that we have at least one representative from each state convention in order that we may sit down and discuss these borderline cases involving the principle of separation of church and state. We are all agreed that you are to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. But when you come to ask what things are Caesar's and what things are God's, there are various borderline cases, very practical and exceedingly important, and we need to have a conference in which our Baptist people who are interested in this question may find some agreement and share each other's views in order that we may be more effective in defense of this principle which is so vital, and in our cooperation with other bodies who are just as interested as are the Baptists. I have this one other remark to ask you to pick up there on your seat next to you. This folder from the Baptist Joint Committee on Public Affairs, and read it in order that you may be informed about our current progress. Now, we are not going to impose upon the time that has been set aside this morning for the address on this subject from our friend Mr. Glenn Archer. I do want to ask that our Executive Secretary, Dr. C. Emanuel Carlson, Secretary of the Baptist Joint Committee on Public Affairs, shall come and
say a word of greeting before we come to the great address of this morning. Dr. Carlson. Dr. C. Emanuel Carlson, the Executive Secretary of the Joint Committee on Public Affairs. Before he speaks, Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of this report.
Is there a second? Dr. Carlson, we're delighted to have you.
It's a pleasure to have the opportunity of fellowshipping with so many of you friends again. I'm coming to feel quite at home, although I do not remember all of the names yet. From here, it is my privilege to go to the American Baptist Convention meeting in Philadelphia, where we will have, we hope, an equally fine fellowship rethinking our Baptist positions and its significance. I count it an honor to have the privilege of serving in this way, and I would solicit your prayers. I hope that we all stop and recognize that we are not dealing in this area with fundamentally political questions. We are dealing fundamentally with spiritual questions. It's not a question simply of our American heritage, not a question simply of an institutional pattern, but it's a question of the freedom of the American soul, the freedom of the Christian to respond as the Spirit leads him. And I trust that we as Baptists will give a great deal of thought and study and discussion to the place of the Holy Spirit in laying the foundation and the basis for our emphasis on religious liberty. We do not want to stand simply on a tradition. We want to stand on firm convictions as Christians, and we want to be led by the Spirit to a clarity of discernment as to what that means in our day. I think I shall not say anything further, but thank you for your prayers and your interest. As the work goes along, there may be more things that the Joint Committee will ask of you. We hope that you will be interested and ready to help. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Carlson. We're happy indeed to have you with us. As many as are in favor of the adoption of this report will indicate it by saying aye. Any opposed would say no. It is so ordered, and we're following this procedure in order that Dr. Binns, chairman of the committee, may introduce our speaker, and that Dr. Binns may close this service or this session in his own way, after which then we will be adjourned until 6:45, the closing session this evening. I urge you again to make it known that a great program is in store for us tonight, and a great program of music, and as we hear Dr. Baker Coffin bring the great closing message of the convention. Dr. Binns.
I'm glad that the Baptists are not the only people in America who believe in the principle of separation of church and state, who are zealous in their defense of religious liberty. And I am proud of the part that was played by Dr. Dawson, the former executive secretary, and Dr. Lurie Dean Newton and the other Baptist leaders in joining with Protestant leaders throughout this country to organize Protestants and other Americans united for separation of church and state. And that new organization was exceedingly fortunate to enlist the services of this great Christian lawyer, Mr. Glenn L. Archer, who has become known throughout all of this land because of his brilliant advocacy of the principle in which we believe. That organization has the full cooperation of the Southern Baptist Convention and other Christian bodies. And you remember how last year Dr. Archer thrilled this convention with his great address. And I'm glad that he is with us again today to speak to us on the subject of religious liberty and the work of Protestants and other Americans united for separation of church and state. Mr. Glenn Archer.
President Warren, Dr. Walter Pope Benz, and messengers of this great conference. Two invitations have especially pleased me in 1957. The opportunity to appear before the messengers of this Southern Baptist Convention today, and an opportunity to appear before the National Conference of Southern Baptist Men meeting in Oklahoma City on September 18, 19, and 20. Many years ago, more years than I like to admit, when I was a small boy, I lived, a while with my grandparents on the family homestead on the plains of western Kansas. My room was directly above that of theirs. More than once, my slumbers were broken by the gentle voice of a saintly grandmother in prayer. O Lord, save my sons. And save my son, grandson Glenn, before the evil days come nigh. These simple, earnest prayers of our Protestant fathers and mothers may be a heresy to some people in this country, but to you and to me, they are not only life's most precious memories, but they are free worship's finest hour. To avoid religious persecution and the denial of God-given rights of a free conscience, our forefathers fled Europe to guarantee religious liberty for their children forever. They wrote the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. And in this noble chapter of human history, Baptists played a heroic part. If I were to choose a text today, it would be, who knows whether Baptists have not come into the kingdom for such a time as this. You all remember the story of the Queen Esther, who was required or pled to serve her race, but before she would intercede, she requested the advice of one of the venerable members of her race, who said, "Who knoweth but that thou art come into the kingdom for such a time?" That queen refused to be intimidated. She assumed the risks. She interceded for her people and saved them. And the courage and success of that little queen has inspired generations of men and women who love religious liberty and who hate tyranny of every kind. Like this queen, our forefathers and our fathers of 10 years ago were faced with a real problem. Religious liberty in the United States was under assault. They might have remained silent, but they chose to act. They organized an increasing strong voice in the behalf of religious liberty in this country. These men and women have accomplished much in 10 years. It may very well be upon their voice and upon the voice of the messengers of this great conference that religious liberty rests in the land. Nearly every one of our denominations today is thinking in terms of church-state separation. Our Presbyterian brethren meeting in Omaha just last week announced that they would oppose by every democratic means the public support of financial monies for sectarian teaching and sectarian institutions. And Dr. Little demanded that the Presbyterians of the United States stand firmly for the principle of church-state separation. And he requested that great organization to take a bold, firm stand. This statement of Dr. Little, the chairman of the Christian Board of Education of the Presbyterians, was not a statement of a bigot. It was the statement of an organization and of a man not given to rash and reckless statements. My own church, the Methodist Church, and thank God for this. My own church, the Methodist Church, has taken a fresh look at religious liberty in the United States. One of the Methodist major commissions, a meeting in Atlanta, Georgia, has accused the Roman Catholics of trying to remove Protestant influences and teaching in certain schools controlled by the Methodists where some Catholics attend. The Methodist Council of Bishops of the Methodist Church have spoken out on church-state separation. The National Council of Churches meeting in Williamsburg, Virginia, has given a forthright statement on this subject. And Dr. Eugene Carlson Blake of the National Council has pointed out certain abuses in the tax-exempt field. The American Council of the Jewish Congress has been bold in its announcement in behalf of church-state separation. The National Evangelical Association has declared itself. And Dr. C. Emanuel Carlson, the director of the Joint Baptist Committee on Public Affairs, continues to give thoughtful and intelligent leadership in this area. In these last 10 years, scores of books, some 85, have been written in church-state separation, and thousands of churches and fraternal groups have written and spoken and studied church-state separation in this country. Organized groups in every state now voice their conviction on the First Amendment. And 2 million copies of The Growing Struggle, which appeared first in your own magazine, Home Life, have been published and distributed to Americans in all of the states. State and federal legislatures are thinking in terms of church-state separation, as the state senator Graham S. Newell of Vermont summarized the legislative review in what he called a speech entitled Double Jeopardy. Protestants and other American leaders have appeared in every state, and hundreds of articles have been written on some subject. And law reviews in many of the colleges of the country are beginning to study the implications so far as the law is concerned in this field. I personally have spoken to audiences in 2,500 cities, large and small, throughout the country. Church State Review, our monthly periodical, has gone to more than 80,000 persons monthly. Our leaders are appearing, our stories are being received. There's a new concern for the principle for which our forefathers sacrificed their lives. There are five ramparts which we as Americans must watch in the United States. The first of these ramparts is the public school, which is the basis and bulwark of American democracy. And the second is the legal right of the parochial school at private expense as a mission of the church. The third of these great ramparts that we watch is the First Amendment, which is the guarantee of a free church and a free pulpit in our land. And the legal concept of church-state separation, which is the only safeguard of religious peace among our different creeds in this country. The fifth rampart, and one that I believe to be more important perhaps than all of the rest, is the free conscience, which unlocks the spiritual power of our nation. Now, these ramparts need watching at this time, because there are enemies abroad in our land and in other lands that would destroy American democracy and religious liberty. There is no American democracy as we know it in Russia. There is no religious freedom as we know it in these Iron Curtain states. Good men suffer for their convictions in many places of the world. The American Bill of Rights is not a part of the communist nations. The United States has devoted its material and material might to become an agency of liberation throughout the world. Our grants and aid go to Yugoslavia. Our doors have been opened to the Hungarian refugees. Poland may be aided by our loans. Billions of our dollars have been used in this Cold War. The Four Freedoms has become the hope and the household word all over the nation where men still cling and love freedom. And our great nation in a few short years has become the single greatest force for liberty throughout the world. And the secret of our greatness lies in the First Amendment to the Constitution, which guarantees a free church and a free pulpit and a free conscience in a free society. Again, what of our times? there is another tyranny as dangerous to evangelical Christianity as communism itself. This tyranny closes our missions and our seminaries. It thwarts free worship in many unhappy lands. Our churches are bombed and burned, and our missionaries die for their convictions, and public religious assemblies are denied, and the dissident religious groups are second-class citizens for no cause except that of their religious convictions. We read and hear a great deal about communist tyranny in our time, but we read and hear too little about Roman Catholic clericalism, which is a denial of religious liberty in many parts of the world. In my humble opinion, the cancellation of a Baptist minister's sermon, and I'm thinking of Dick Hall, to a Baptist group of soldiers in Madrid is not unlike the denial of a Roman Catholic freedom to preach in Russia or Poland. The closing of a Christian church in Colombia is of the same evil pattern as the refusal to let a Roman Catholic priest pray in Russia. The denial of a permit for Protestants to build a hospital with their own funds in Naples, Italy, is no different from crushing religious institutions behind the Iron Curtain in Hungary. What is the difference between closing a Christian theological seminary in China and closing one in Spain? These are all examples of tyranny. They are wrong. They are ugly. There are no examples or no choice between them. I intend to condemn religious tyranny wherever it is found and by whomever committed. I'm opposed, too, to the more subtle kind of tyranny which, in the name of brotherhood, writes to the Chicago newspapers about this very speech and by implication suggests that the newspapers of this city remain silent about these talks. I am against tyranny of all kinds, period. Now, our concern for the denial of religious liberty abroad is matched by our concern for the denials of religious liberty at home. We must oppose the use of tax funds for churches because they violate our tradition and our law. Public taxes for sectarian teaching and institutions amounts to the establishment of a single church or a combination of church contrary to the Constitution of the United States. The chief violator of these laws are the Roman Catholic hierarchy of the United States. Roman Catholic bishops denounced church-state separation in their official pronouncement on November 1948. In that statement, they promised the American people that they would work for the destruction of the principle which denies them public monies for their sectarian teaching and institutions. The bishops again spoke in 1955 asking grants and aid for their institutions and for their schools. Father John Courtney Murray, one of the most distinguished and I think the most profound Roman Catholic philosopher in this country, has said, speaking in the Catholic Mind in November 1956, there's no longer any reason why we can't support Roman Catholic schools in this nation. And Richard Joyce Smith, writing in America Magazine, September 1956, has declared the time has now come for the use of public money for Roman Catholic schools. And there are 600 Roman Catholic-controlled newspapers and periodicals that go out to 22 million Americans every month, which are slyly and effectively calling for public taxes of all of us for their institutions and their schools. There are 150 different Roman Catholic agencies with avowedly good purposes who carefully, effectively express their desire for public monies for their institutions. And to this view, some 4 million Roman Catholic young minds in more than 15,000 parochial schools of this country are indoctrinated to this very same view. And taking advantage of the teacher shortage in our public schools, the nuns have moved into public schools in 34 different states and are there carrying on, according to our own lawsuits, a sectarian type of education violating our law and our tradition. And here, too, a novel interpretation of church-state separation is given to more than 3 million of our public school children. In many communities, public schools have almost died out and have been supplanted by parochial schools. And in one state and in one community, the public school was closed down by a sectarian superintendent and a sectarian board of education. And I refer to Bradfordsville, Kentucky, in Marion County. Now, these bus transportation bills aimed at subsidizing one religion have been introduced in more than a dozen states. After we had outlawed bus transportation in Kentucky, in Missouri, in New Mexico, in Pennsylvania, bus transportation bills were immediately introduced that were designed to destroy the Supreme Court's ruling in these states. In Augusta, Maine, our Roman Catholic action groups threatened to send more than 900 pupils over to the public schools unless the school board give them their demands of public money. Only 7 were actually transferred. The board held its position. It appropriated $100 to make a test case, and the High Court of the state of Maine held that the board's ruling was sound. But there is no question what they sought. Public monies for private schools in violation of the Constitution of Maine and the constitutions of all of our state. This incident was proof of the demand. In fact, in view of Rome's age-old quest for public monies for its institutions, in view of so many pronouncements by so many top leaders in all parts of the country, in view of these efforts in a practical way to get public money, can there be doubt any longer that the hierarchy of the Roman Church wants its institutions supported by all of us who pay taxes in this country? Are we about to pay taxes for the kind of an educational program that refers to our converts and to our Christian leaders as half-saved? Are we about to pay taxes to support an educational program that teaches that our religion is a counterfeit? Are we about to pay taxes in this nation to an institution that provides that public tax money shall indoctrinate our youth into the concept that separation is a compromise and that there must be support for one true church? The greatest pressure now being exerted by the Roman Catholic hierarchy to obtain subsidies is in the bus field, and we might take the case of Connecticut. During the last session about a year ago, there was carefully slipped through the assembly a bill that was designed to carry on a survey of education in that state. This survey was designed to study educational activities in the state of Connecticut. But what happened? The moment that survey was passed and monies were appropriated and the study began to be made, that survey became a sounding board for the Roman Catholic hierarchy in the state of Connecticut to obtain public tax monies for sectarian teaching and sectarian institutions. That not only became a sounding board, but Mr. Joyce Smith, who was a member of the state board of the education in the state of Connecticut, spent a great deal of time speaking over the state and pointing out the time was now right for the use of public tax money for sectarian teaching and sectarian institutions.